New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson was abruptly fired from the paper Wednesday, less than 3 years after she was appointed the first woman in this top media job.
Now, the media world is abuzz with speculation over exactly why this happened. One theory that's getting a lot of play is that she had confronted her bosses about her compensation, which she said was substantially lower than that of her male predecessor, Bill Keller.
Her dismissal also highlights the ongoing struggle of women to break through the glass ceiling. And when they do break through, like Abramson, do they have to be tough and demanding and likable? Rachel Laris from the Women's Media Center joins us now. She oversees their media monitoring program. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So there's been a lot of speculation about the exact reasons for Jill Abramson's dismissal, but the New Yorker, CNN, other media outlets have saying that it may have been because she confronted her boss about pay discrepancy between herself and her predecessor. What do we know about the why?
Well, we don't know. We actually don't know all the facts because the New York Times has not actually been very transparent about why Jill Abramson was let go. You know, we do know that she wasn't dismissed because of her management of the editorial content in the New York Times. It was actually doing quite well. So, but if the reports are to be true, it seems that Abramson was judged by a different standard than her predecessors.
And there is the why, which we don't know, and there seems to be a lot of back and forth about it was compensation, it wasn't compensation. But on another level, does it really matter why she was dismissed when sort of the big story is, you know, a top woman executive fired, and this also coming close to a similar situation with Le Monde, the paper in France, where the top woman editor there was fired too. Does it matter how much why?
Well, I think it could matter, but I think the way that the Times has handled this situation is actually is why many people have thought that her gender might be a contributing factor. And honestly, the outcry and the bad publicity that this is really generating for the Times, I think, really demonstrates how much the issue of gender disparity really can't be swept under the rug these days. You know, some people I've heard are talking about unsubscribing because of the actions of the publisher, and I think other newspapers should really take note about how badly the Times looks in this situation.
Why haven't we heard from Jill Abramson herself? Do you think she has a confidentiality agreement?
I think a non-disparagement agreement is probably a common thing that that most people have to sign when they leave.
As far as women in the media go, we've got the one hand, you know, looking at the compensation issues, and at the other, there have been reports citing that it was more of her demeanor in the newsroom and that she may have been pushy or overly aggressive in creating a certain kind of atmosphere, which raises a whole different set of questions about expectations for women and how they comport themselves when they're in these high-level jobs. What do you think is key to that discussion?
It's really interesting to know that past New York Times editors have been known to be, you know, brusque with staff, and they were still actually seen as effective. You know, Harold Raines was also known to be not particularly well liked in the newsroom, and he was actually not let go because of his unpopularity. He was let go over the scandal of Jason Blair and plagiarism, which was really the issue that was embarrassing the paper, not how Harold Raines treated his staff. And, you know, when the famed executive editor Abe Rosenthal died, his obituary actually noted that he was, and this is a direct quote, that he was abrasive, a man of dark moods, and he could humble a subordinate for an error. This was in his obituary, and he was seen as, he's one of the famed editors, past editors of the New York Times.
Well, you hear quotes like that, and they almost sound like a badge of honor.
For men, it might be, but obviously women are judged by different standards than men.
What is the current picture in other media organizations? How do the numbers of women in editorial roles like this in the newsroom compare, you know, in other media landscapes?
You know, it's precisely because there are so few women and, frankly, people of color occupying top leadership positions in the media is why I think this firing is really having such resonance. You know, with the Women's Media Center in our Status of Women in the U.S. Media Report, which was released earlier this year, noted that across all daily newspapers, women comprised only 36% of newsrooms and were only 34% of supervisors. And our own research of the bylines of the New York Times that we just put out a few months ago found that the male reporters were dominating the paper by writing 69% of the news articles in the New York Times.
And what about the compensation? Do we know anything about whether the men writers are getting paid more than the women writers?
You know, we would, I think the public and a lot of people would be really interested to know. But the fact of the matter is, across all industries, women are paid less than men. And this has been verified by both the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau. So I have no reason to believe, we have no reason to believe that the situation in newspapers would be different than the rest of the work industry.
We hear a lot, you know, lately the expression lean in has gotten a lot of traction thanks to Sheryl Sandberg talking about how women need to step it up and, you know, kind of deliver maybe even more than their male counterparts. But is that really, I don't know, a good strategy? I wonder, looking at something like this, some people are saying leaning in can get you fired. What is the right strategy for a woman in a top job?
Every woman is going to have to make a decision of what she feels comfortable in doing in terms of her particular work situation. This is why systematic change is actually really what's important, and why groups like the Women's Media Center make a point to calling attention to the gender disparity where it exists. Because if you don't identify the problem, you can't change it. And I think systematically, this is something that can only be done as a systematic level, rather than putting the burden of the effort on individual women to change men and the world's behavior. It's something that we all have to do, and it has to be done, with intention.
Well, let's talk about that. You're calling for systematic changes so it doesn't fall on individual women, which makes a lot of sense. What kind of changes are you calling for?
You know, at least in terms of the media, we have, in our Status of Women in Media report, we actually have a list of recommendations that we have run for ways that we can at least change the gender representation in the media. And that includes, you know, simple things like staffing with intention, having outlets be aware of who they're, you know, the ratio of hiring, and also things like what type of sourcing who they're talking to. One interesting study of the front page stories of the New York Times noted that in addition to men obviously writing more of the front page stories, men were also quoting more male sources. And so I think it was at four times as many as the number of, as the stories that were written by women. So even keeping track of who the newspapers are quoting is a really great way of just noting the differences in men's voices and women's voices in the media.
A lot of people in the media, including, you know, National Public Radio, are interested in hearing from diverse voices. Isn't this something that's already happening in newsrooms?
I hear a lot of good intentions, and I think that it is something that could be changed. But I think a lot of outlets aren't really keeping track of these numbers. This is actually why the Women's Media Center, in order to help reporters, has actually created a She Source database of women experts, so that any booker or reporter who's looking for a female expert on any topic, really, can come to shesource.org and find great women experts, so that they can never say, honestly, I looked and I couldn't find any woman to talk about finance or about the environment or about healthcare. So the women experts are out there. I just think that it sometimes reporters can get very, I hate to say it, but lazy and go back to the same people over and over again instead of searching out new voices.
Obviously, a systematic change like that would take some time to implement. In the meantime, there's a cultural thing going on, at least reportedly it seems to be going on, that, you know, women, they haven't broken through in equal numbers in lots of the top paying jobs, like CEOs and executive editors, journalism and elsewhere. What about that problem, you know, when they do break through, what they might confront culturally in the office?
Yeah, that's a real issue, and I think that that's why it's really important for groups to continue talking about the concept of inherent institutional sexism. I think there's sort of a concept that sexism is something that sexism is only implicit if you think that, you know, women, you don't want women to have the right to vote or not to have a job, and that's just not true. There can be systematically ways that discriminate against women, one of which is how they may be penalized for either having children or not having children, or even as you say, their demeanor in the office. These are ways that women can be systematically discriminated against in ways that their employers and managers and supervisors may not even be aware that they're doing.
We're going to continue this discussion with Rachel Laris of the Women's Media Center in just a bit, talking about Jill Abramson's dismissal from the New York Times and what it could say about women in top media positions and other high-ranking positions.
It's 4:36. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're exploring what New York Times executive editor Jill Abramson's dismissal earlier this week could mean for women in the media. With us is Rachel Laris, communications manager for the Women's Media Center, where she oversees their media monitoring program.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Would you like to hear, as our guest does, more women's voices in the media, whether as journalists, broadcasters, editors, or sources? Do you think women face unique challenges, especially as they enter the upper echelons of the workplace, media or otherwise? What are those challenges? Do you see them where you work? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
We're going to go right to our callers now and take Steve from Rhinelander. Hi, Steve.
Hi there. I would like to compliment the people doing this show. I hear two very talented and articulate women, and I think that just kind of proves the point that the only thing necessary is just to have the person that's best qualified for the job get the job, rather than putting up artificial barriers because someone happens to be a man, you know, rather than discriminating against men. I think that everyone should be judged equally. And that's all I have to say. Thank you for the great program.
All right. Thank you, Stephen. Thank you for the compliment. Rachel, is that enough to just go for the best person?
You know, it's interesting because in hiring, when sometimes what ends up happening is that people define the person who's most qualified as somebody who looks and sounds and maybe is educated the exact same way that they are. And so, therefore, it's the concept of defining who is really well qualified that you end up seeing that kind of homogeny in hiring. So, and it's really to the news media's benefit that they expand their hiring portion beyond just a small circle of white men that typically are hired and promoted. And this is because they'll get better stories. They'll get better voices. They will not be blind to sort of demographic changes that are happening in this country. You know, minorities actually comprise only 13% of newsrooms, despite 37% of this country not being white. And I don't have the figures for women at the New York Times, but I know that they are only 19% of the newsroom. The New York Times is actually non-white. So the newsroom is not reflecting the readership, and I think that it should.
A lot of the coverage that at least I've seen all of it, but it tends to reflect rather poorly on the New York Times. I've read some stories saying that this was a humiliating way for Jill Abramson to have gotten fired, that it was abrupt, that it may have been unfair in terms of her asking for compensation. But do you think that something like this happening and unfolding the way it has could deter people from hiring women because they're worried about backlash?
I don't think it should deter. If anything, I think that this is an example of why it's important to have women, because the lack of women in top roles are really getting a lot of attention these days. Media Matters, for instance, just put out an infographic that noted that with Jill Abramson's departure, there's only two women who are the top editors of the top 25 newspapers in the U.S. It's Newsday and Houston Chronicle both have women as executive editor, and they are the only two newspapers that are headed by a woman right now. And that's, I think, something that is going to get a lot more attention, you know, even in the next few days. And so I suspect that a lot of media owners are going to be thinking, how can they avoid this sort of bad publicity, especially when they may be called to account by other, you know, by other reporters and, frankly, outlets like yourself.
What do you hope the New York Times management does going forward to communicate a willingness to be fair and to, I guess, be in good faith when they're working with women and minorities?
What was really great about Jill Abramson was she had a strong responsibility to promoting gender diversity as well as frankly pay equity. And when we at the Women's Media Center showed her our study of the New York Times bylines and asked for a comment, she acknowledged that they were not doing as good as they could, but pledged to do better. And under her dominion, they actually, the masthead of the New York Times, I think, was up to 50% women. So that's really, those are some really great strides. And I would like to hope that in the wake of this news, that the publisher and the new executive editor will continue this kind of work and make sure that women's voices are well represented as well as voices of people of color.
Is it important, do you think, that the New York Times, you know, does that going forward, considering, you know, the kerfuffle that we're in right now over this? How important is it that the New York Times really does come forward and try to encourage women to and be represented in their company and elsewhere?
I think the paper, with its lack of transparency about this situation and the way that this is really turning into some bad publicity for them, has a responsibility to their readership and to the public. I mean, there's a reason the New York Times is very proud of themselves and being called the paper of record, and they are going to want to restore their credibility and their readership's faith by, I think, taking steps to make sure that the women who, and frankly, that they're the women who work there, the men and women who work there, can expect to be paid equally for equal work and can expect to be not discriminated against because of their gender or their color.
I have been reading lately that we need to focus more on the men when we talk about gender equity in the workplace. How have men been left out of this conversation?
I'm curious. You've heard that men are being discriminated against?
Men have not been discriminated against, but when we're encouraging a culture that's positive for women and allows women to rise, that men need to be included in that conversation and to be made to feel that they're stakeholders as well as the women.
Well, change is never going to happen, you know, with only 50%. Change doesn't happen when only the group that is affected wants change. Change happens when there is a force that, frankly, can require the groups that are being disempowered, the groups that are in power, from buying in. I think that it is important that men recognize that discrimination hurts them, and frankly, the concept of gender roles being strictly assigned to both men and women hurts them as much as women. So I think everyone benefits from the types of strides that feminist organizations and feminist leaders are trying to achieve. I have male friends that stay home, are stay-at-home dads, and they are not looked down upon for doing that. And I really think that this is the kind of changes that are important. They're happier now doing that than forcing themselves to be the breadwinner.
Rachel, are there things that media outlets and journalism schools can do to encourage women to break into the media now?
You know, there are great journalism schools, and I think that one of the things that I've really been noticing is a community of just sort of the interconnected community, the way that social media helps reporters across the country kind of stay in touch with trends. And so before, you would have a bunch of women working in a newsroom, and maybe it would just be literally a handful feeling really alone and feeling like, you know, we can't seem to make change just happen at our newspaper, and not realizing that there may be a whole group of women across the country that were feeling the same way. So I think the one of the benefits that has sort of happened in the sort of new social media age is the way that these conversations are happening, not just sort of in, you know, in unhappy hours, I guess, between staffers who want to talk about their problems, but basically out in the public and, you know, with everybody. You know, the readers, I think the audience is taking part in this, the audience being, you know, newspaper readers and media consumers are taking part in this as much as journalists themselves. And I think that that is how we are going to get to a place of change.
Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for really being, you know, caring about this topic.
Absolutely. That was Rachel Laris, Communications Manager for the Women's Media Center, where she oversees their media monitoring program.